This is a download of Briar Road, one of the 5 shortlisted entries for the BBC National Short Story Award 2015. And it also includes an interview with Jonathan Buckley, the story's author. The reader is Maxine Peake. I have the address, but it's not necessary to know the number. Briar Road is a street of 60 houses, and I could have found the right one blindfolded. It emits a frequency that cannot be heard, but can be felt. It has the aura of evidence. Most of the houses in this street are in need of some repair. Paintwork gnawed by the sea winds is falling away. Window frames are rotting. The house to which I have been called, however, shows no damage. The father's van is showroom immaculate, though far from new. Other people in this part of town are struggling, but in this house there is money enough. As was to be expected, it is the father who opens the door. The father was the one who read the statement to the press. The mother was in no state to talk. He is small and lean, and the rolled-up sleeves are tight on his disproportionate muscles. His gaze is confrontational and too steady. It would not surprise you to learn he used to be a boxer. When I introduce myself, I manage 4 or 5 words before he interrupts. "Come in," he says, standing aside to let the intruder pass. The atmosphere of the house is familiar. The air is becalmed. This is the stillness that follows calamity. "Through there," the father orders, jabbing a thumb. I step into the living room, where there is nobody. Having dealt with me, the father steps back into the hallway and calls up the stairs to his wife. There is no need to do this. She knows I have arrived. The seating is arranged symmetrically around a glass-topped coffee table on which a newspaper is lying. A faint fume of polish is in the air. My feeling is that the house is always neat and clean, but is even more so now, partly because housework, of course, is something that might offer respite from thought, and partly because it is important for the family to control whatever can be controlled. A form of sympathetic magic is at work, it occurs to me, as I examine the room. If everything is done correctly, the greater order will be restored and their daughter will be returned. And to surrender to disorder, to even the slightest degree, would be to surrender absolutely to the worst. The father returns to the living room and sits. I note the tightness of his mouth and the tension in the muscles at the hinge of his jaw. In such circumstances, the father is under extreme and particular strain, because the father is always a suspect, as is the boyfriend, should there be a boyfriend, which in this case there is not, as far as anyone knows. If no boyfriend has been discovered by now, it's certain, almost, that there is no boyfriend. So the father is not immediately trusted, and for good reason. Weeping fathers have proven to be liars many times. This man has had to demonstrate his innocence. He has had to recount his actions on the day in question, hour by hour. Others have corroborated what he has said. But there is often a fault in such stories, a flaw that does not become apparent for some time. There will be people still who do not believe him, because it is often the father. This time, though, it is not. I know this. His wife comes into the room. She is more or less my age, but she looks a decade older. She moves as if using an invisible stick. With something like deference, she puts out her hand, which I enclose between mine. Her hand has no weight in it. It's like holding the body of a small bird just killed. Her eyes are sore. "The boys aren't here yet," she apologises. "In 10 minutes they'll both be here." She suggests a cup of tea. "Thank you," I answer. One must never decline, no matter what one's preference. Left to cope alone, the father can come up with nothing but the bluntest of questions. "So is this what you do?" he asks. "For a living, I mean." Oh, no, I answer. I have a day job in an office. So this is an hobby, he proposes. I wouldn't say a hobby, no. I reply, and I smile, unoffended. It is essential in all cases that tension should be dissipated as it arises. How did you get into it? He asks. I tell him briefly how the faculty was revealed to me when I was a young woman, when a relative was in crisis and I knew what was happening to her, although we were in different countries. It would not be appropriate for now to reveal that this relative was my twin and that I could not save her. Women's intuition, the father comments. If you like. His wife brings in a tray. A young woman accompanies her. She is 20 years old, I would say, and is 6 or 7 months pregnant. She is nervous. This is the other daughter. She sits on the sofa beside her mother and takes charge of the pot and the cups. The mother asks about the showroom girl, but I cannot tell her much in addition to what she has already heard. Everything is fine between the showroom girl and her mother, I tell her, which is almost true. Confidentiality must be respected. The showroom girl is the case that has brought me here by word of mouth. She went to a festival with friends and did not return. The police were alerted but could find no trace. But I went to the house and spent time in the girl's room with the mother, and I could reassure her that no harm had befallen her daughter. In time, she would hear from her. Her daughter was in London, I told her, and was happy. And she was indeed living in London and happy with another young woman, which is something else I could have told the mother, who had come to me after hearing about the young man in Poole that had gone into town for the evening and vanished. He would be found living rough in a town that had some significance for him. I had told his parents, and a year later he came home, having been sleeping on the streets in Southampton, where a girl they had never heard about was living. He had forgotten who he was, I explained. The Southampton story is an element of my bona fides, the summary of my successes. I make no great claim for myself. Some people can hear notes that others can't. Some noses can detect a dozen elements in a perfume that to other people is a single scent. That's what it's like, as I tell them. The father's attention is not focused on what I'm saying. Several times, as I'm speaking, his gaze is directed narrowly at my mouth rather than my eyes. It has been said that my lips are the best feature of my face, and I have endeavoured also to make my voice pleasing. Its pitch, when I began, was a little higher and the timbre more astringent. The father finds my voice agreeable, I can tell, though he is inclined to dislike me. But he would describe himself as a man who likes women, and as a man whom women tend to find attractive. This is obvious. Some years ago he was unfaithful, his eyes tell me, as does the glance that his wife gives him. He will be unfaithful again, I am sure. I can make no promises, I say. I explain that it is not simply a question of opening a secret door and listening. Every case is different, I tell them, but I may be able to help you. I have finished what has to be said. Could I see her room before we start? I ask her. The father needs to be told why this is necessary. It has to do with becoming attuned, I explain. I don't know what that means, he responds. His wife leads me to the stairs and up to the daughter's bedroom. She opens the door gently, as if the girl may be asleep inside. This is it, she says in a whisper. I take a step forward. I'll leave you, she says, and the door silently closes on me. The police must have examined the laptop that's on the desk. They would have discovered the stuff that old girls hide from their families but disgorge to friends and pseudo-friends on the internet. None of it has been useful. Otherwise, nothing seems to have been touched here. This is another aspect of the magic. There must be no interference with the attributes of the missing. To rearrange this room would be akin to giving up. So the room is as I need it to be. I lie down to absorb what the room contains. A huge birthday card, homemade, is pinned open by the head of the bed. Love You is written in gold and crimson glitter. All around the mirror, boyish actors and singers smile at her. Amid the friends, the girl herself appears on a beach with her sister. A soft pink horse stands on a shelf above the bed, besides a small Eiffel Tower. This girl is guileless and much younger than the showroom girl, though not in years. Bubbly is a word that has appeared in the papers, as it often does in such cases. There is certainly a great deal of jollity on show here, as there was not in the room in showroom. The pictures in the showroom room were postcards of old portraits. The books were indicative of thoughtfulness, of a more inward character than is evident here. I see no books of any kind. This is the room of a child. She has not escaped. The showroom girl had escaped and was alive. I sent right away. And when the stepfather, came home and shook my hand, I knew beyond doubt that I was right from the way his eyes shrank away from me. "My princess," he called the girl, and the word was putrid in his mouth. In the room below me, a voice is grumbling. I close my eyes to summon the CCTV picture, the last image of their daughter, leaving a shop in a part of town in which she has no known friends. She raises her hood and steps out into the rain. I take into my body the air that only this room has. This is not a house like the showroom house. No love is left between these parents, but the situation is an ordinary one. Many children come through such things uninjured. Mine did. This girl was happy here. She has been loved. Silently, as if impelled not by myself, my lips form the words, "She has not run away." I hear a double slam of car doors, then a key in the lock downstairs. No sooner am I on my feet than the father knocks. "Everyone's here," he announces. "You ready?" "I am," I answer, taking care to betray nothing. As he ushers me out, his eyes perform a rapid search, looking for signs that the drawers have been opened and belongings disturbed. The sons are awaiting me at the table. The older, his father's workmate, mid-twenties, is clearly attending under protest. I am something of a surprise to him. He had expected a fairground tarot card act. Like his father, he takes note of the figure, but more blatantly, as if by agreeing to participate in this nonsense, he has earned such entitlement. But the other son, 2 or 3 years his brother's junior, is a more personable young man and is more willing to enter into the spirit of the thing. In the light of the setting sun, the wall I am facing is a block of radiant tangerine. It is too bright. "Would it be possible to draw the curtains?" I ask. The older son raises an eyebrow. The implication is that he suspects me of intending some sort of sleight of hand under the cover of semi-darkness. "We must minimise the distractions," I explain. "I'm not going to be distracted," he tells me. "There's nothing going on outside," he says, and he gestures in the direction of the street, inviting me to check for myself. His sister looks up into the corner of the ceiling. She is not close to our older brother. "It will help me concentrate," I clarify, in a tone that might be taken for an apology. By now the mother is at the window. For a few seconds she stands there, one hand on the drawstring of the curtain, looking out. The evening is beautiful, the sea burning all the way to the horizon. What she sees is an affront. The vastness of the sea and the sky, the countless rooftops, the traffic flowing away all the time, and it terrifies her, feeds her grief. Her child is lost somewhere in this immensity, or perhaps is no longer in it. I thank her and extend a hand to ease her back into her place in the circle. I become aware of the bright red dot that is glowing on the television set. I ask for the equipment to be unplugged and for any phones to be taken to another room. Then we can begin. We should join hands, I say. The older son, of course, smirks at this. This is what has to be done, I tell the gathering quietly. What we are performing is a ceremony, and this is the form that the ceremony takes. When the circle has composed itself, I pause for a minute, directing my gaze downward. One by one, the five participants do the same. Now, we should close our eyes, I say. My voice is quieter now. The quality of the voice is important at all times, in any such ritual. It is theatrical, some might suggest, and this is not untrue. Now, we must be silent, I say, after a minute. And I would like you to think of nothing. Our breathing has become harmonious and hushed. The circle is receptive, or as receptive as it is possible for this circle to be. I need you to picture her, I tell them, when we have reached the moment. I need you to listen to her voice. Soon, she appears. I see the girl rushing into the rain. She pulls up her hood and runs into the downpour and disappears. Again and again, she disappears. Then I see, vividly, a scarf, a gold scarf. From the reports in the papers, I know she was wearing a scarf of that colour. Slowly, a landscape is clarifying. A hill, a low hill, no trees, some wind-blown bushes, an outcrop of boulders. This is a crime scene, but I am creating it. I do not see the dead, nor where they are. The dead are dead and beyond reach. They do not speak to me, and I do not see them. My talent is not a special sight. It is something for which I do not have a name. When contact is made, a kind of shimmer runs through me. I cannot describe it. A new scene begins to manifest itself, a path in woodland and clothing strewn among undergrowth. The scarf is there, but it has no colour. A barn, a derelict barn, is surrounded by silver birches. This, I think, is a memory. It is a dreadful place. A memory of a place that frightened me many years ago, revived by the dread that has been seeping into me since the daughter's room. The girl is dead. That she will be found by a ruined barn in woodland is nothing more than a coincidence, or perhaps a form of prediction, just as one could have predicted the arrest of a single man aged 35 to 45, a man who kept himself to himself. I do not see her killer. And what I saw was something I was imagining, I knew, and so I remain silent. I do not provide a commentary on everything that I experience in these situations, though many would prefer a performance of that kind. What's going on? The older son interrupts. I know that he's watching me, but I continue without comment, without opening my eyes. The memory of the barn and the birch tree is fading, and still I have no sense of any presence. Out in the street, a man shouts. A single sharp snort is expelled by the older brother. It is becoming apparent that he did not care enough for his missing sister, and is troubled by the beginnings of guilt. I open my eyes and propose that we change the structure of the circle. Under my direction, the father takes the place on the left of his wife, but she stays with me. She takes her husband's hand. This is the first time they have touched since I arrived at the house. We prepare ourselves for another attempt. Silence is again achieved, but this silence has a quality of falsity, of simulation. It is not the true silence of submission. Now, I see, at a party, someone who resembles a missing girl. She is with the friends from the pictures in her room. Sympathy is doing the work, but it is not sympathy with the missing girl. It is sympathy for the family. I want to help them. By an effort of will, I remove the pictures, but the involvement of the will is always an impediment. I am failing. Other faces emerge. I see the showroom girl, the Folkestone girl, the Colchester girl who's never been found. So many faces appear of the bereft and the abandoned and the hopeful. It is all interference which cannot be overcome. I have to end it. Defeated. I go back into the room. I'm sorry, I say. Nothing is happening. All the hands unlink. I retain the mother's until last. What does that mean? She asks, stricken. If the girl were alive, I would know. If the circumstances were ideally conducive. But here they are far from ideal. There is so much resistance. I cannot say, I tell her. All we know for certain is that I have not succeeded. I apologise again. Should we try once more? She asks me. But already her husband is pushing back his chair. I think the result would be the same. I tell her. The mother stays at the table as all the others rise. Reaching into a pocket, the father says to me, "So what do we owe you?" "Nothing," I tell him. "We must give you something," his wife says to me, "for your time." "No, nothing," I repeat. The father does not press the point. "I'll take you home," he says to his daughter as he pulls back the curtains. In the hallway, the sons are putting on jackets. The younger one brings back his sister's phone. "Thank you," he says to me, giving me his hand. He will not meet my eye. From the doorway, his brother looks in. His gaze slides past me on its way to his parents. "Call you later," he says to them. Then, with a sniff of disgust, he is gone, taking his brother with him. "Well," says the father, looking at me. The tone of the word is interrogative and indifferent. His hands remain in his pocket. All I can do is apologise again, which is what I do. "Let's go," he says to his daughter. She picks up her phone, turns it back on, then offers me a brief and disappointed smile, as if coming to suspect she has been deceived. The mother is still seated. "Stay a while," she requests, touching my arm. If I leave now, the house will be empty and unbearable. I sit beside her. I place my hand over hers. "This wasn't his idea," she says. I should not take offence at her husband's attitude. "I don't," I assure her. As a rule, I can see the husband's ideas are the ones that prevail here. "He's devastated," she says. "We all are." "You mustn't give up hope," I tell her. "Never give up hope." Undeceived, she says nothing, and the sentiment expires in the air. "Shall we move the table?" I suggest. It seems that she has not heard me, but then she answers very quietly. We can do that later. She looks at me for 5 or 6 seconds, steadily. She releases my hand and turns to gaze at the window. Together we sit in silence for a minute or more, with our faces in the sallow evening light. As if listening to the sentence of a judge, she nods her head. "She was so lovely," she says. No words could be of use. No words are ever of any use. One can only attend. I place a hand on her arm. When the tears begin, I offer her an handkerchief. She takes it and presses it to her eyes with force, baring her teeth. Sometimes love can be rekindled in suffering, but here the opposite will happen, I know. Men find it difficult to love, as women do not. "Her daughter was beautiful," I tell her. Whatever I say to myself like a priest who has long ago lost his faith. But silence would be worse, I think. "So many regrets," she says. Her voice is a murmur. Her eyes are riven by anguish. I stand up to move my chair so that I can face her squarely, and I take her hands in mine. We are joined, with her left hand in my right and her right in my left. There is no resistance now. If the daughter were alive, I would know it. Our hands are resting on my knees as she talks about her daughter. She smiles and weeps, speaking softly. Her gaze is fixed on our hands as if they were instruments of devotion. I will help her. She knows. When the violence of her grief has begun to abate, she will call on me. A year from now, or perhaps two, when the husband has gone. It is a mortal affliction, and there is no cure for the pain of it. There can only be palliatives, of which love is the strongest. And she understands what I am offering.
The author Jonathan Buckley started out as a travel writer for the Rough Guide series. He's been described as wonderfully accomplished, but as a recent review of his latest novel, Nostalgia, pointed out, he's the kind of author who is consistently overlooked for prizes. That could change, as he's now on the shortlist of the BBC National Short Story Award. His entry, Briar Road, is told through the voice of a medium visiting a family whose daughter has gone missing. In the first of our interviews with all the shortlisted authors, here's John Wilson talking to Jonathan Buckley ahead of the broadcast of his shortlisted story, read by Maxine Peake.
I have the address, but it's not necessary to know the number. Briar Road is a street of 60 houses, and I could have found the right one blindfolded. It emits a frequency that cannot be heard, but can be felt.
The story grew out of notes I made for a novel that never became a novel, that was going to have a medium as its central character, but the narrator in that case would have been male, and the setting would have been something quite different, and I could sense it was going to turn into something like a sort of substandard Muriel Spark novel. So I put that aside. Going back to my notes, I came across a page I'd written with this idea, and a few pages on the idea of writing a book about a crime, but dealing entirely with the aftermath, where the central character would be the victim of the crime, but he or she would never actually appear in the story. And then the idea of bringing that together with this idea of having a first-person narration by a medium of somewhat sort of ambiguous integrity.
Yes, I'm glad you say that, because we don't know whether she is credible right until the end. I'm not going to give anything away. In fact, we don't even know who she is. We don't know her name. We have some idea of what she looks like, but we don't really know. There's no scientific basis to her investigations.
No, I mean, I hope at the start it's not even clear what she is.
Exactly.
I mean, I think
could be a journalist. I thought a journalist as she arrived at the
door. I'd hope that the outset one suspects that this person is either journalist or is in some way involved in a police investigation. And I would hope that the gender of the narrator is not readily apparent until the male members of the family start to look at her. Mm. It became apparent that that first-person narrator had to be female, because what I was interested in above all was the dynamic with the family. Had you had a male narrator going into that environment, the dynamic would have been entirely different. Mm. The dynamic above all between the narrator and the mother, I think, is the central thing of the story.
The mother is still seated. Stay a while, she requests, touching my arm. If I leave now, the house will be empty and unbearable. I sit beside her. I place my hand over hers. This wasn't his idea, she says. I should not take offence at her husband's attitude.
And just stepping back from the story, yep. You as a person, how do you approach this subject normally? As a sceptic, as somebody who thinks this is mumbo-jumbo?
I don't believe in it, certainly, but I wouldn't want anybody to come away from that story thinking that this narrator is a fraud.
And the way that you suggest she's receiving is through she's tapping into vibe somehow. She's almost sniffing the air. She's getting a sense of presence.
That's how she presents it, yes. I mean, you could read it as though this is somebody who really has a highly developed sense of empathy, that what she's picking up is actually the mother's emotional state, and she might from that extrapolate the existence of the girl. But of course, I won't give it away, but I wouldn't want anybody to think this person is necessarily a charlatan.
So you started with the idea of the medium. It could have been written up in the form of a novel. So you tapped into this idea when you saw the National Short Story Award, and you wrote the story specifically for the award.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been a long time since I've written something as a short story, as a self-contained brief piece. My novels tend to be episodic, and I tend to see things episodically rather than as a long, continuous narrative. So it wasn't a great change of direction going to this, but nonetheless, you know, I haven't previously written texts that I conceived to be brief and standing entirely on their own.
What about the rough guides, which I read about? You were one of the editors and wrote about those rough guides to Europe.
Yes.
I mean, those are like little short stories, vignettes, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I think I've got a fairly precise sense of place. I do tend to think sort of topographically, and I conceive books in terms of the locale and people moving in and out of them rather than as a continuous story. And perhaps that's sort of a frame of mind that may be particularly well suited to writing guidebooks on the one hand and the type of novels that I write now.
The other four stories shortlisted this year are also available to download. You can find these and many other readings, interviews and reviews about your favourite authors on the BBC Radio 4 website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.